This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, Russia's sports ministry is denying running a state-sponsored doping cover-up and says it'll maintain its zero-tolerance approach to cheating. It's after an independent report found over 1,000 athletes from the country benefited from Russian secret police hiding failed drugs tests. Professor Richard McLaren's investigation says London 2012 was corrupted on an unprecedented scale, along with other events.
We are now able not only to confirm the findings of the first report, but also to put them into sharper and clearer focus. A cover-up that evolved over the years to an institutionalized and disciplined medal-winning strategy and conspiracy.
Police chiefs say 83 potential suspects have been identified by forces investigating claims of child sex abuse in football. 98 clubs at all levels of the game are linked to the allegations. Our sports correspondent Paul Kelso says the scandal has intensified over a short space of time.
We are just 3 weeks and 2 days since Andy Woodward, the former Crewe Alexandra player, went public with his story, and it uncorked a bottle that is continuing to spill out stories of very similar abuse from right across the country.
A terror suspect with a loaded assault rifle has been arrested in the Dutch city of Rotterdam. Investigators say that he was held during a raid on his home, where they also found ammunition, illegal fireworks and an image of an Islamic State flag. Up to 10,000 private school places could be offered to children of low-income backgrounds at no cost to parents. Independent schools say they'll cover the difference, providing the government puts in money too. Sky's received a takeover bid from 21st Century Fox. The broadcaster says it's accepted the deal in principle, with its share price soaring 30% on the news. And UK sports announced British athletes in archery, badminton, fencing and weightlifting won't get any funding ahead of the Tokyo Olympics. They lost out after failing to reach their medal targets in Rio. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is leader of the Liberal Democrat group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news in a week, we keep hearing about ISIS terror attacks planned in Syria but happening here in Britain and across Europe. What is Gladio C? And what evidence is there the 7/7 London bombings, Paris, Nice and Brussels were actually orchestrated by Islamists? Also, as Russia and the Syrian Arab Army liberate Aleppo and 1,500 terrorists return from Syria to Europe, the EU, Europol and the new boss of MI6, Alex Younger, are warning of this new wave of terror attacks. But FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds just tells us all about what she discovered of this Gladio network of NATO terrorists trained to blow up innocent people and blame those attacks on Islamic people. Also, as Network Rail gets ready to be privatised, what will it mean for passengers? Or are we just simply the last in the queue when public assets are auctioned off by the city? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, wet and windy, I'm afraid. This weekend, highs of 11, still reasonably mild, not too bad, is it? Showers tomorrow, mainly cloudy on Sunday, with some sunny spells and feeling colder. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, some wet and windy weather and sunny spells. Next weekend, 17th and 18th of December. Highs of 10 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Helping us review this week's news, it's the leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show again.
Hi.
Gary, you've had all sorts of problems in the past with, at least the Lib Dem group on the City Council has, with the government's prevent strategy that they have tried to sort of get Bristol to just simply implement. Can you just explain how you've managed to tweak it to make it, what you think, better here in Bristol?
Well, a few years ago, it was originally actually under the Labour government, but it carried on and possibly went even further in the wrong direction under the present government. And we were dealing with ministers who couldn't seem to actually pronounce the word Muslim without extremist being tagged onto the back of it like a hyphenated word. There was just no understanding of the community as it was in Bristol and the way to actually make things work. So they sent down and said, if you want some money, you'll do this, this and this. And we said, no, thank you very much. You can keep your money because we don't want to do things that way. And eventually they did, you know, come round to our way of thinking. And actually we had some very progressive people in the police down here who worked with us. And we were able to do things a completely different way round so that we had a more balanced approach to things. And we dealt with the, you know, the right-wing extremists as well and very effectively. And actually we made the chair of the, it was called Building the Bridge, rather than prevent, it was the Muslim community were actually leading it, and we were supporting, and it worked extremely well. But it's gone downhill, I'm afraid.
Well, we're also joined by Dr. Saffron Carlson from Bristol University's Department of Ethnicity and Citizenship. I mean, she's a sociologist. Hi, Saffron. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Gary.
Actually, I'm Tony. He's Gary.
Oh, sorry.
It was fascinating to see a double-page spread. Actually, usually I open the Evening Post. I think probably you're the same, Gary. And I flick through, I find maybe one or two articles worth reading. But actually, two pages of really good analysis of how this prevent strategy has failed in the past. And you make quite a provocative I don't know if it's you, but it may be just be the headline writers, the sensationalist headline writers at the Bristol Post, saying that actually it could be harming integration, this prevent strategy, rather than helping it in Bristol. So is that you, first of all, is that your words, and secondly, what's your take on prevent?
I'm not sure if those are my exact words, but that's definitely a sort of position that I agree with. It's interesting that much of the discussion around prevent has talked about a lack of Muslim engagement, a lack of recognition of a sense of Britishness existing within the Muslim community, and that's been the reason for the justification for a lot of the initiatives that have been introduced around prevent, trying to encourage community cohesion and integration, things like that. And our research has suggested quite the opposite. It agrees with the evidence that comes through from the sense of very wide and very strong sense of Britishness existing among the Muslim community. So our research suggests that around 90% of Muslims in Britain feel a strong sense of Britishness, and also don't perceive any incompatibility between their Britishness and their Muslim identity. So don't perceive this inherent incompatibility, which also seems to drive much of the discussions around prevent. The other issue, the reason why I think this is problematic, is that these, something that we found very strongly influencing levels of Britishness and a sense of Britishness among people with ethnic and religious minority backgrounds, is experiences of racism. And that's not only about people being attacked in the street or verbally abused, it's also gaining a sense that they aren't welcome in a society, which comes from a number of different ways, including through government policy and media reports. So actually, my concern is, and the risk is, that the initiative like Prevent actually can contribute to this sense among communities that feel British, that actually they're not considered British and that they don't have a place in Britain, and that actually directly contributes to a lack of social cohesion and a lack of sense of integration.
One of the ways the government's trying to address this is having this kind of thing where you swear an oath of citizenship. Do you think that helps? Is that actually going in the right direction?
No. I mean, I don't think that there's an issue of integration that needs sort of responding to. I think it's also problematic in that many of these initiatives require quite a lot of sort of financial outlay and a different sort of engagement, which is sort of beyond the economic means of particularly many Muslim groups in Britain, I think. So, no, I'm not convinced that that's an appropriate way to respond.
We're quite used, aren't we, to having a Jewish diaspora right the way around the world, really. In every major city, you've got Jewish people living there. They often, you know, people just would simply say, well, OK, some of them are Orthodox Jews, but those that aren't will identify very much with the host country, and they see themselves as primarily part of that country, not necessarily primarily from their ethnicity. So why do you think that Islam has been treated in such a different way?
I don't know, is the short answer. I find it very difficult to understand why the empirical evidence seems to suggest very strongly that Muslims in Britain feel British, but that there is this persistent argument that they don't, and that there's a problem around the way that Muslims live their lives in Britain, that needs to be addressed in some way, because it doesn't seem, as I say, to correspond with the evidence that we have around this issue.
Hang on a second, Gary, because I just want to say this is all part of something called the Casey Review. Can you just explain what that is?
So the Casey Review is a very large government-funded year-long review, which collected was quite a comprehensive engagement with evidence from a range of different places and a number of different sort of experts were involved in the gathering of evidence and with the engagement with Louise Casey around talking to them about community engagement and how to improve sort of community cohesion. And I have a number of colleagues who were also involved in the process and had very high hopes for the recommendations that might come from that. But unfortunately, we seem to again have a set of recommendations which resort to the same sets of arguments around problematic Muslim Islamic cultures and Muslims and the things that they're doing to segregate themselves from society and to isolate themselves from society when, as I suggest, I don't think the empirical evidence supports that position at all.
I think the position in somewhere like Bristol is massively different. I think in Bristol we have a huge mixture of different groups, different races, and I think that there's an understanding here of multiple identity that people can actually be of Pakistani heritage but still be proudly British, and you know, I think we do understand that. I think to be fair to Louise Casey, who I've worked with previously when she was dealing with troubled families, I think, to be fair to her, she wasn't actually personally pointing the finger at the Muslim community. I think it is the case that in some communities in the north of England there's been a separation, and she's not necessarily putting that down to one group or the other. It is a case that the integration there is not the same as it is here, and I think that's a little sad.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, it looks as if the government has come to this whole prevent strategy with the back of their sleeve or up their sleeve or behind their back, a kind of sub-agenda that actually it's really about Islam and Islamic people that need to be integrated into British society, and they're not doing it properly as yet.
Well, an obvious point that MI5 made after the invasion of Iraq is that was that caused radicalisation within the community. And I think that's well understood across the board. And, of course, if you do single out a community for what are perceived to be unfair treatment, then the younger and more alienated members of that community may indeed be radicalised. And you may, in fact, be actually creating the very disengagement that you're hoping to overcome. Mm. And if we're going to defeat terrorism, then there's got to be an understanding that it's not by no means the Muslim community's attitude to support it. And what happened in Bristol is the only serious terrorist incident we might have had when a Muslim convert threatened to blow up the galleries, it was the Muslim community which went to the police and pointed the finger in the right direction and, without being prompted.
And incidentally, following up on that, would-be terrorist has now, with influence from Imams, has actually now become a positive beacon for saying, I was wrong, and has actually helped in the de-radicalisation agenda. And one of the ways that we were able to make progress in Bristol was by addressing concerns, you know, about racism. So, you know, searches at the airport, which were unfairly done and that sort of stuff, you know?
I think as well, though, is that there's some... My concern with the Casey review is that it doesn't always understand the complexities that there are underlying some of these situations. So I think she talks a lot about the socioeconomic disadvantage that people live in, but there isn't sort of the understanding of the ways in which that affects people's lives and their sort of attitudes. And also she talks quite a lot about... Young Muslim men, particularly, in this idea that they have this sort of culture clash and they're torn between their British identity and their Islamic identity. It's a similar sort of argument that we saw from Tony Blair. And she talks very much about how this crisis is occurring outside of the sort of British political system. But what's actually interesting is when you look at the research with young Muslim men and women, what they express is that they do experience a frustration, but it's because they perceive themselves as being British. They perceive themselves as being British citizens, and that being a British citizen comes with certain responsibilities, but it also comes with rights. It comes with a freedom of expression. It comes with a freedom of religious sort of orientation, but that actually, whilst they're British citizens, because of their Muslimness, that is being denied them. So the frustration isn't separate from the British political system. It's actually part of the ways in which they're engaged with.
Interesting, Martin, isn't it? So Britishness is very difficult to pin down, but one thing it certainly does mean is that we're tolerant of different kinds of cultures.
Well, it's all about cricket, isn't it? As any Pakistani will tell you. I think this idea, I mean, especially from the Indian subcontinent, many of the Muslim communities here are from the empire, where, you know, Britishness was dinned into people over generations, and there's a very strong cultural identification with British values, and especially young people who've grown up here, you know, mixing with others of their generation. They feel as British as anybody, and quite rightly so. And I think the radicalisation agenda that they're pushing, there is an issue here. But I think it's we have seen in recent years that MI6 have been involved in trying to use radical Islam as a method for overthrowing the government of Syria. And they've been working with other intelligence agencies and armed forces around the world to channel jihadis into that conflict.
Well, we'll be talking a bit about that in the second hour, but certainly it's absolutely clear in Afghanistan they were using jihadis in order to try and overturn...
This goes back to the 1980s.
Overturn the Russian regime there. But look, I put this to you, Saffron, that we've got this week, we've got Europol, we've got MI6 and the EU all warning us of a new wave, a potential new wave of terrorist attacks across Europe, possibly even here in Britain, which are being orchestrated from Syria. So surely it makes sense to have something like the PREVENT strategy, which is targeting Islamic radicals.
Well, my question is whether it's targeting Islamic radicals or whether the problem is that it's targeting a whole community. Obviously, these are incidents which have affected a lot of people, but actually they're being orchestrated by a relatively small number of people. So rather than looking at the number of, you know, these are very effective in terms of causing lots and lots of disruption and lots of death, but actually it's only being caused by a relatively small number of people if you compare it to the size of the Muslim population in the UK. So my concern is that the ways in which Muslims have become seen as sort of guilty until proven innocent, and there's this expectation that they should behave, that they are guilty until proven innocent, and that there's this inherent problem to Islam which isn't present for other religions. But that this focuses on entire communities and criminalises entire communities, and that is not the way towards improving social integration or community cohesion.
I mean, I think anyway, I quite like having people who are radical, you know, people who are actually maybe pushing back against the state and saying, actually, you shouldn't be doing this, British government. You know, we've just had Theresa May, for example, this week sitting down with all the dictators of, the kings, they're not dictators, they're just kings, of Saudi Arabia, etc., over in the Gulf states. And there's a big questions about whether these are the right people to be having supper with. And also, of course, when it was in the run-up to the Iraq war, something like 1 million people came to London, the biggest ever demonstration. Now, you're not going to try and tell me these are all Muslim radicals. Of course they're not Muslims, and they're not they're radical, but there's a much wider thing, Martin, isn't there, actually, which is radical, and it's building in this country, and it's not just about people who go to the mosque.
No, it's not, and I think the anti-Iraq war movement in which many of us participated was very encouraging because it was multiracial, very much so. And I think that anybody suggests that that is in defiance of British values needs to have a word with themselves. And I think that a lot of British policy has been responsible for creating ill feeling, both in this country and elsewhere. And as I mentioned earlier, underlying all of this, I'm afraid, is a suspicion that the minority, which are radicalised, are being radicalised not by themselves, but by agents from within the state structure. And what we've seen in the United States, it's absolutely clear, is that scores of people have been convicted of so-called terrorist offences who were in fact just hopeless loners and losers with a Muslim background who've been entrapped by the FBI and would not be convicted in a British court. And certain cases have collapsed in this country where people who were... the guy who was a Swedish citizen was put on trial at the Old Bailey for planning to go to Syria to join jihad. He successfully defended himself by claiming that he was actually going to join a group which was supported by the British intelligence services and armed forces, and therefore he wasn't convicted. Now, what has to happen is that when we have terrorist offences, we have judges and juries and courts for a very good reason, because there's state can be involved in terrorism. We saw that in Northern Ireland. The Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972 were, according to the Garda Síochána and the head of the Irish Supreme Court, Henry Barron, who wrote the Barron Report, they pointed the finger very firmly at MI5 for being involved in those in those terrorist attacks. The state can also be a terrorist. That doesn't mean that the state is always the terrorist, but the state can also be a terrorist, and that must be understood, and that's why the police need independence to investigate these things.
I'm going to put my two halfpence in there, because the Secret Services lie, don't they? Just after the 2005 London bombings, we had immediate statements from the security services that these four alleged bombers were clean skinned. We'd never heard anything about them before. Anyway, when it actually came to court, Martin, and this is where you're absolutely right to point out about this being important, that it's actually these cases are actually heard, because often people are killed and there is no court case.
Yeah.
It's that we discovered that for around about a decade, one of the 7/7 bombers had been being followed, and two of the others for something like 5 years. So they weren't clean skins at all. Anyway, look, I'll just leave the last word to you, Saffron. How do you think that they could do this better?
I think by beginning by acknowledging that the vast majority of Muslims in the UK feel very strongly British, feel very committed to a life here, but one that can accommodate both their Britishness and their Muslimness, so come from a position of cooperation and assume a level of cooperation and integration, and then work with communities to identify those who aren't working with similar aims, would feels to me a much more effective approach than one which begins by problematising entire communities.
And I'll put it... sorry, Gary, yeah?
That works. That's certainly the way that we started off doing things in Bristol. I think things have slipped back a bit recently, but certainly by saying to the Muslim community, right, well, we've got this money, now what issues do you want us to address and how can we actually deal with this? And it actually produced some very positive results.
Well, there's some good news to finish with. Dr. Saffron Carlson from Bristol University, Department of Ethnicity and Citizenship, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. Now, let's go over to you, Gary, because you've got a bit of gossip from the City Council, haven't you? You've got various bits and bobs I know you wanted to share with us about things that have been happening.
Well,
where do you want to start?
Well, that's probably a very good question. Where do you start? I mean, we know that the previous administration left... undone a lot of things that they said they'd actually done, So the financial mess in a city council is even worse than it would have been. But I'm afraid the reaction to it in some ways has actually been not very helpful. There's been sort of panic reactions. And we're now in ridiculous situations where we've got, you know, staff running around doing jobs of developing things that, you know, and there's no money to actually carry them out.
Can you give us any, because I mean this is one thing that does often happen in politics, isn't it? You'll get a leader like good old Marvin and will say, are we going to do this, we're going to do that, and then someone taps him on the back and says, actually Marvin, we can't afford that.
Well, no, I mean the budget is in such a mess that the chief executive has been brought in, well, temporary chief executive, is actually saying, well, we can't deliver any of this that's in the manifesto. And it's really a matter now of a panic reaction to try and get the budget to balance and produce a legal budget. But in the process of doing that, some areas which are important but very small amounts of spending are actually being thrown out the window.
Now, I'm quite surprised to hear this from you, because I would have thought I'd be hearing this from Marvin making big public announcements saying, actually, we were elected to do this, we want to do this, but the government isn't giving us enough money to do it. So why isn't he doing that?
We're not hearing quite as much as I thought we would be hearing, actually. I mean, he's personally a much more pleasant chap to deal with than the previous mayor. You can actually speak to Marvin, but the difficulty is that there is a difficult problem to deal with. But what I'm not seeing is a clear way through and a clear way of tackling the problems that are actually there and prioritising what can be done rather than, you know, sort of things that can't be done. And the stuff that's going out for consultation, which would just be impossible to actually deliver, but, you know, when the public come back and say, you can't do that, we were just asking them. And I'm afraid that, you know, the budget is not in good shape at all, and I don't see any positive ways for that the administration is actually producing results.
Yes, Labour doesn't really seem to be doing very well, does it? Come on, Marvin, pull your socks up. Here in Bristol, we'd like to see that, even if they have got problems with the leadership and difficulties there. And we had a by-election yesterday, didn't we? Labour in the Independent, it says today, that'll probably be in tomorrow's paper, Labour hits a 7-year low in a new poll after a by-election drop from second to fourth place. Martin, I think you're the person to answer this one. A poll has placed Labour at its lowest point in 7 years, hours after the party was beaten into fourth place by UKIP and the Lib Dems in a by-election. YouGov survey put Labour on 25%, 17 points behind Theresa May's Tories, while Jeremy Corbyn was also behind the Conservative leader, who people think would make the best Prime Minister. This is the by-election in Sleaford yesterday and North Hykenham. A veteran MP, Labour MP, warned the party is heading for electoral disaster and that its leadership shakes off its bunker mentality.
Well, obviously it's not very good news from our point of view. It would probably, you know, what the obvious thing for me to say is we haven't been helped by having the infighting that we've
had. That's all over. Excuse me, that's all over.
No,
you can't just keep pointing past, Martin, and saying, oh gosh, you know, that's why. One of the main things that's been pointed to here is the reason is because Labour doesn't actually have a policy still on immigration. It has contradictory policies.
Well, no, it's got a contradictory policy because people have got contradictory ideas about it. If we're going to stay in the single market, which is what the Liberal Democrats would like to do in many left-wing Tories, then you cannot control EU immigration. And also, of course, immigration that's non-EU, it's very difficult to control anyway. If Syria collapses and Turkey collapses as a result of Syria's collapse, there's going to be a lot more people coming via Greece and ending up at Calais. Of course, the French might not necessarily stop them at Calais anymore. Well, they might end up in Kent. It's very difficult to do anything about immigration.
Just as much as anyone else actually knows the difference between refugees and asylum seekers and economic migrants.
Understand that in the Brexit referendum, people's hostility towards foreigners to court was if you like, made respectable because people were saying, well, we're only really worried about EU immigration. But plenty of racists voted for Brexit, and not all people who voted for Brexit were racist by any stretch of the imagination, but plenty of racists did vote for it because they saw it as an opportunity to kick foreigners in general.
Now, I would say probably most racists did vote for it, but that doesn't mean to say it's a bit like KKK making a big fundamental problem is the way our
political system works is that you've got two parties locked inside the Labour Party. You've got the more radical socialist wing of the party represented by Corbyn and probably people like myself, and you've got a more centrist managerial we've got to manage capitalism, and we've got to we've got to accept the basic construction of society and just tinker at the edges side of the Labour Party. Now, if we had a proportional electoral system, as all our neighbours do,
it's nothing to do with that, Martin.
It is, because on 25%, Tony, if we had 25% in an electoral system, which was PR, we could then form alliance with other people who agreed with us, like the Liberal Democrats, and we would be functioning like Germany or Denmark.
I want to hear
Italy.
Something very simple. Why have people like Marvin Rees and Jeremy Corbyn not got a vision for the future that people want to vote for?
They have got a vision, but some people don't want to hear it.
No, we're not hearing it, are we? We're not hearing it. It's not the media's fault.
No,
it's
think
just that they don't
have a vision. Accusing Jeremy Corbyn of not having a vision.
They don't have a cohesive
He's
vision.
He's got a vision. The problem is that many of what he's proposing is runs against the grain of the way our society is best organised.
As you said yourself, it's a contradictory vision. No one's going to vote for that.
No, it's not a contradictory. What you could pick up on, but you haven't, is that he's against the single market, but he's in favour of taking a strong line of pro-immigration. Now, that's a very brave position for him to take, but you can't say that it's not a visionary position. It is a visionary position. Now, that's because of his left-wing background. He doesn't accept the single market, but he accepts immigration from the EU because he went to the Socialist International meeting in Czechoslovakia last week, and he said to the other parties, socialist parties gathered there, we mustn't compromise on our pro-immigration stance. Now, that really causes a groan in some parts of the Labour Party, because they're saying, well, look, everybody's banging on about immigration. Surely we could just take a kind of, sensible, let's control immigration line. Even if we can't, we could just say that. But he's saying, no, we've got to take an internationalist position. Now, that, of course, taking those kind of positions doesn't necessarily win you by-elections, especially when you've got the press against you and all the rest of it. But, of course, it's fundamental to change the electoral system so that view can be expressed, and other views can also be expressed. I think you're just dodging
the issues and blaming the system, not the policy.
No, I'm
I
not.
Think in actual fact, the Liberal Democrats have demonstrated recently we are the most internationalist party. Be very positive on that area, and it's not doing us any harm. But at the same time, because as well as taking that positive stance, we also look like we're competent in terms of economics, etc. And actually, people are thinking, yeah, well, maybe that does make sense. Maybe we ought to actually be more open and more honest about things, and it's not doing us any harm.
Well, I think that's right, but I mean, what should happen in a proportional system is all sections of the electorate should be properly represented and have their views represented. I think your views on the single market and of course your years in coalition with the Conservatives when we carried out an austerity policy which has now gone out of the window because it can't be worked. But you supported it all those years, even though everybody now agrees that it was wrong. But I mean, the point is that our electoral system forces internal fighting within parties. Because there is no way that you can actually get a spread of views as we do on this show and then try and find consensus. And it forces inevitable conflicts, which then, of course, damages the way in which debate is conducted and the kind of discussions that we have. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people can huff and puff about immigration, but the world we are living in now, as we go into a recession probably, and probably increased wars, there's going to be a lot more people moving around than there were before, and it's not going to get better anytime soon.
Okay. Also, we've got some figures this week, Gary. Migrant numbers are hitting new records. Official figures reveal more arrived from across Europe than ever before. This is, guess what, the Daily Mail. 284,000 are coming to the UK in just 12 months. Just to recap how the UK population is changing, we've got 4.1 million in population increase between 2001 and 2011. Half of that increase is due to immigration. 2.8 million people in Britain are Muslims, the biggest religious group after Christians. 70 to 85% of the population in some wards in Blackburn, Birmingham, Burnley and Bradford are Muslims, and 511 schools in 43 areas take more than half of their pupils from Pakistani or Bangladeshi backgrounds. Also, finally, 27% of births in 2014 were to mothers born outside the UK. So we were in a very changing country, Gary.
Yes, and probably all the better for it as well.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because just looking at the next story, if I can find it, it's British workers are living in poverty and they are at a record high. Housing costs are plunging millions of British people into poverty, but they're not unemployed. This is Tom Peck in The Independent on Wednesday. The number of workers living in poverty has reached a record high as the UK's housing crisis fuels growing insecurity. Research by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation showed 3.8 million workers, or 1 in 8, are now living in poverty. Low wages are regularly cited as the cause of in-work poverty, but the rising cost of rented housing is also pushing working people into extreme financial difficulties. A total of 7.4 million people, including 2.6 million children, are now living in poverty despite being in working households. Number of people living in poverty in the private rented sector has doubled in the last decade to 4.5 million, Joseph Rowntree Foundation said. Well, you know, you're saying it's a great benefit to immigration. I'm sure there are many benefits, but one of the downsides is we've got only a limited number of jobs, and
that's just not true. There is not a finite number of jobs and a certain number of people fighting to get them. The fact that our economy has been open and is bringing people in is actually massively increasing the number of jobs. And I'm afraid I don't accept the Daily Mail line, even if you do, that the reason that we've got people on low wages is because of all these foreigners coming in. It's basically because the systems and controls do not allow for proper distribution of the benefits of an ever-growing economy.
No, but don't you think big business likes to have cheap labour, and that's one of the reasons we've got a pretty much open doors policy?
Well, naturally, big business wants that. Small business wants it. Individuals want it as well, you know. They find that it actually works.
So much of our policy, Martin, is set by big business. The lobbying power of these people is incredible. And this is certainly one of the contributing factors to allowing, actually driving wages down.
It's one of the factors, but it's not the only factor. Also, the complete gutting of trade unionism. The level of strikes in Britain is the lowest ever over 200 years.
Well, that comes with mass unemployment, doesn't it?
It does. But the mass unemployment is a result of economic policies. There's no reason why we should... The level of unemployment is actually decided by the economic policy you pursue. We could have full employment, as we used to have in this country, but there would then be more inflation, which would mean that wealthy people would find their assets devaluing as things went forward. And that's how the 1970s, which people think was such a terrible time, the inflation in the 1970s protected the living standards of the workers, but it undermined the profitability and of the wealth.
Okay, Gary first, then you, Martin. How are we going to fix this? How are we going to get people on proper wages, enough to pay the bills, enough to take the kids on holiday?
Well, I think firstly you've got to look at the state has got to have a significant intervention on this. So, for example, you know, if you ask people, do you value nurses more than some other jobs which are paid more money, they will say, no, we value the nurses. So, basically, you do have to redistribute positively through the state. You also need to, in actual fact, make certain that we improve the supply side on the economy. So it's all very well giving subsidies out to private landlords, through housing benefit, but a far better way of dealing with housing, which is one of the major causes of poverty, is to actually build a few more council houses.
But that takes ages to do, doesn't it? It takes a very long time. And I was chatting to someone earlier this week who was saying in order to get a private rented house in Bristol, they had to show, the person said, well, as part of the application to take this flat, you're going to have to show all of your last 6 months' bank accounts. We want to see every penny that went in and out of your bank account before we'll even consider you taking a flat.
And if you were a private landlord, you'd probably do exactly the same thing as well. It's not very good for the tenant, but basically you need to move to a situation where you've got a reasonable supply of housing and affordable housing, which I'm afraid under the present rules and regulations is just not happening. And that actually is one of the most fundamental ways you can actually change people's lives, is by providing social housing at sensible cost.
Well, obviously, I agree with that. And what's happened is since the 1980s...
Well, we're not doing it, are we? Come on, let's have some solution here.
No, but the solution is that we're not doing it because we've not... Because what's happened is we had 13 years of Labour governments and they didn't change the rules and regulations about this. And then we had the Liberals in coalition with the Conservatives, and they didn't change them. Now we've got the Tories back again, and they have not changed them. In actual fact, they've tightened the screw by bringing right to buy into the social housing sector. Now, the fact is, if you spend 30 to 40 years doing stupid stuff, like not looking after council houses, then you get a problem. And that problem then feeds into the people not having enough wages, the undermining of trade union bargaining power, etc. I mean, in the Swedish system and the Scandinavian social democracies, the unions were at the driving seat for years and years and years, and they've got much better stats about this stuff than we've got. And that's because they did stuff right when we didn't. Now, what I would suggest also is not building new houses. There's plenty of existing housing stock which could be bought up by the government and turned into social housing. You don't even have to build new stuff.
What about those people at the bottom? And I mean, it's all very well the Joseph Rowntree Foundation report there talking about British workers living in poverty at a record high. And I'll put links to all these stories, of course, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you want to follow any of this up. But we've now got 2,000 disabled people wrongly declared fit to work by the DWP in just 3 months. This is again a story from The Independent this week, around 2,000 disabled people wrongly judged fit for work by the DWP. I mean, this is basically kicking disabled people. It's extremely ugly. Tragedy also of an unknown homeless man found frozen to death in the city centre in Birmingham. This is last weekend on the coldest night of the year. And to add insult to injury, we've also got this horrific regime of benefit sanctions. So people are left with absolutely no money at all, not even to buy food or toilet paper. And that was brought up in Prime Minister's questions this week. So I'll come to Gary and Martin and ask them about that after we've heard this clip too.
Patrick Brady!
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, how does closing Mary Hill Job Centre in my constituency, one of the most deprived parts of the country, help my constituents who want to find a job? Does he accept that travelling further to other centres will mean increased costs for people already on the lowest incomes and an increased risk of sanctions? Why does this government continue to target the poorest and most vulnerable in our society?
If the government has been targeting the poorest and most vulnerable, it is in getting them back to work in record numbers, and it has been... And it has been in providing a boost to the pay of people on low pay through the introduction and the increase in the national living wage. I wish that the Honourable Gentleman were prepared to welcome and celebrate those achievements.
If you thought that was not maybe Theresa May slowed down or something, no, it wasn't actually. It was David Lidington, who's the leader of the House of Commons, standing in for Theresa May, who's off abroad. But Martin, what about the wider point there, closing down job centres in the poorest areas in the country?
Well, you know, my views on this are pretty clear. This is a deliberate attempt to make the lives of the poorest more miserable in order to win votes in the swing constituencies under our corrupt political system, where the few hundred thousand people who are basically reasonably well off get fed a load of nonsense about how people on benefits are all skivers, and that wins general elections in our ridiculous system. And the Labour Party has not properly opposed, because they want to try and win under that system as well.
Well, I think that we need to go back to the previous question with regard to how do we solve this mess. The technicalities basically are that local authorities have got to be given more authority to actually do things like borrowing money to build houses, and actually that would reduce some of the costs rather than exacerbate the problems. We pay out fortunes in housing benefits for very little benefit at all to the people that the money goes through, because it goes straight through the hands of the tenants and straight to the landlords, and it doesn't do the system any good at all. I'm afraid I'll disagree with Martin in terms of buying up private property to convert to council housing, because I think the problem with that is that you just shove up the cost of the private property even more.
The housing benefit system does anyway. It props up the housing market, doesn't it? That's why they're happy for it. Yeah. To carry on.
Whenever
like
you see new houses for sale nowadays, but certainly if it's a reasonably large block somewhere in the city centre, maybe been designed for families or whatever, it always seems to say investment opportunity, not a house.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case in Bristol, and it isn't quite that way all around the country.
Have you been up to Finsall's Reach, right in the city centre, where they're doing all that, putting that new bridge in, for example? Loads of those places, beautiful flats been built, half of them, some of them, in some of the blocks, still empty. Well, not been sold.
Yes, although I think that they will sell them. It's the price that they will be sold at, and I guarantee that the developer will make a huge amount of money on that, as other developments in Bristol. But of course, they couldn't afford to provide a few social housing units, could they?
Well, how has that happened? Because in the old days, you guys, we used to actually strong-arm these developers and say, well, yes, we'll give you your planning permission, but we want some social housing.
Yes, and unfortunately, the rules were relaxed, and the way in which that assessment is now done of is it affordable to provide social housing have been skewed in the developer's favour. And really, we need the ability to revisit, and I think there's a possibility of this now coming back, where you can revisit a development afterwards and say, yes, you did have the profit margin there to provide the social housing, and that needs to be, effectively needs to be an audit on what's actually happened. And I think that would bring some of the developers more into line.
One of the places I remember that first happened was the Bristol General Hospital site. It was absolutely gorgeous, beautiful flats being built there.
Yep.
And John Savage, who was running the United Hospital Care, is it Bristol Hospital Trust, chairman anyway, made quite a song and dance about the fact that, oh yeah, we'll be able to get some affordable housing. Then we suddenly find, oh, the goalposts have changed, it's all going to be luxury.
Yes, and in actual fact, the planning committee at first took the right decision to say, sorry, but we're going to withhold planning permission because we want some affordable housing. And then there was a huge fuss from some people in business and from the Evening Post saying that the planners were being unreasonable, they needed to get on with it. Sorry, but the planners were right. And when that's audited at the end of the day, I'll guarantee there's enough profit in that development to have paid for a fair amount of social housing.
It's a bit of a racket, Martin, isn't it?
It is, and it's been going on for decades now. If you do a silly policy for 3 or 4 years and then you reverse it, you can say, well, then you've got a chance of doing something about it. But if you follow an absurd housing policy for 40 years, then you're going to end up in a cul-de-sac, and that's where we are.
Well, I mentioned David Linnington, leader of the House, who stood in for Theresa May this week. On the other side of the chamber was Emily Thornberry. Well, she did something which really makes me fume, which is ask the same question 6 times. And here was her final attempt at asking about what the government was doing and what was its negotiating position, which, of course, she's not going to be told. A bit of a scratchy record, really, over Brexit.
Emily Thornberry!
The fact is, and he knows it, we all know it, that he can consult as much as he likes, but the answer will come back, we should be part of the customs union. It is hugely disappointing that on a day when the government is committing to greater transparency on its intentions for Brexit, we're getting the usual stonewalling. We have a government that's promising to tell us the plan while refusing to give us answers to the most basic of questions. We have a government promising to give Parliament a say when they're spending we don't know how much of taxpayers' money across the road in the Supreme Court trying to stop Parliament having a say on this. In short, we have a government that cannot tell us the plan because they do not have a plan. They do not have a plan. In February, the Leader of the House said when he was hearing about what he was hearing about from the Leave campaign was confusing, contradictory nonsense. My final question is this. Are we hearing anything different from this government today?
Mr. Speaker, we will publish, before Article 50 is triggered, a statement about our negotiating strategy and objectives, as the Prime Minister has said yesterday. But the Honourable Lady seems again to be in a state of utter denial about the consequences that flow from the referendum decision. No other EU government is seeking to reverse or question the legitimacy of that vote in the way that she and a number of her colleagues are still trying to do. But I'm afraid that just indicates how distant the Labour Party now is from any aspiration to be back in government again. We watch them in action. It's like it's quarrelling like Mutiny on the Bounty as reshot by the carry-on team. They are
there's far too much noise. I want to hear the words flowing.
reason why the chair should be denied the hearing of these matters. It's very important, the leader.
They are rudderless. They are drifting on Europe as on so many other aspects of policy. It's little wonder that so many decent working people who for generations looked to Labour to be their champion have given up in despair and are turning to this party as the authentic voice of working families.
Well, I'm joined by two Remainers in the studio. I won't call you Remainers. Maybe you're... I don't know if you would even confess if you were, but Martin, this is really pointed at you, because that was really an attack on the Labour Party by the Leader of the House there. In denial, rudderless and drifting.
I think that the question that was people were put in the Brexit referendum on June the 23rd is whether you want to be part of the European Union. It didn't say, do you want to be part of the single market or not? Now, Norway and Switzerland are both... not in the European Union, but they're part of the single market. David Davis has already said that he might be prepared to pay into the euro budget, as the Norwegians and the Swiss do, in order to gain access to the single market.
But what about free
movement? If you're going to have access to the single market, you cannot control labour movement. It's not part of the deal. Now, that has not been resolved, and at some point the political system in Britain is going to resolve it through through a collapse of the Conservative Party.
I don't know if it's the political system in Britain that is going to resolve it. Surely it's going to be part of the negotiation process.
No, there's no negotiation. If you want to be part of the single market, there's got to be free movement of labour. That's absolutely clear. Philip Hammond knows that absolutely clearly. He and the City of London and the CEOs and all the major people who actually run the industry in this country know that if you want to be part of the single market, you cannot control immigration.
They want their cheap labour, don't they?
They don't.
What about you anyway, Gary? Are you a Remainer, a Ramona, or a Remainer, or both?
I think very much that the British public ought to be given the deal at the end of the day and say, do you accept that or not? That is democracy.
I thought they'd already decided. People have already decided.
People decided they didn't like the European Union deal
They decided they wanted to leave.
They therefore said, "Well, you know, we don't like this." But that's not the same thing as saying, "Do you like what you're being offered in the future?" Because they don't know what they're going to be offered. And they've not seen what will actually happen. So, and that absolutely is a matter of fundamental democracy. It's very easy to vote against something, which is what 52% of the population actually did, and for a whole variety of different reasons. I mean, we know, as Martin said earlier on, that some people just didn't want foreigners in this country. The irony is that probably that minority... Of people who voted Brexit, that smaller minority who were racist, in actual fact, were very much more concerned about the people from outside the EU than those from within the EU.
Well, no doubt this will go on and on. I don't want to go on and on about it anymore. One of the stories this week that caught my eye, actually thanks to Simon Chapman at the National Union of Journalists here in Bristol, for this one: High Court injunction stops the Mail on Sunday reporting police investigation into businessmen. Now, this hasn't really been reported by the papers, hardly at all, but it has been by Hold the Front Page, which is a sort of insider... It's basically aimed at journalists and editors. A High Court judgment's found a suspect in a police investigation has a reasonable expectation of privacy, which is likely to trump the press's right to freedom of expression. Well, some businessman here has paid a lawyer a lot of money for this. A decision was made by Mr. Justice Nicol in ERY versus Associated Newspapers earlier this year. Police investigated suspected financial crime and raided the premises of two companies. These raids were reported in the local press and subsequently came to the attention of the Mail on Sunday. A title contacted a prominent and apparently wealthy businessman, ERY in brackets, concerned in the operation of one of the companies, seeking a comment. On the record response was provided by ERY's public relations representative, following which an article about the matter was published in Mail Online. Press release was then given on behalf of ERY. So what's happened is, this has been reported in the press, but then the prominent businessman who is part of this investigation has then decided to buy a bunch of lawyers and take it to court and say, we want an injunction, you can't report because it's a privacy matter.
Well, let's see if he gets found guilty, shall we?
I think that's the problem with something like this. Unless we know what the charges are and what the case is about, it's hard to make a judgment.
Well, my point of bringing it up really is about this whole thing of a super injunction. If you're being investigated for a serious crime of some sort, number one, it's already been reported, and then number two, you're saying, well, I actually don't want any more reporting on this. I mean, this is not a free press, is it?
No, but you'll understand that there are rules about things being sub judice and so on.
I tell you what, there's another rule, and that is that someone who's poor has no chance of affording this.
Of course.
And someone that's rich can get a super injunction.
Well, indeed.
But I think there's also conflicting with that, innocent until proved guilty. Bluntly.
Well, no one's saying he's guilty. They're saying he has been raided by the police. That's all these press reports are playing. You think that's okay?
We all know that certain papers are able to portray somebody as absolutely guilty when there's no evidence, substantial
actually,
evidence.
Actually, you can say pretty much whatever you want as a journalist until and we do have some freedom of the press there, until the person's actually charged. This person hasn't been charged, so surely there should be just complete free and open reporting of what's actually happened and already been reported. I'm getting a bit annoyed about this, that neither of you pair of you seem to think there's anything wrong in just saying one of the well-known name across the country has been raided by the police and no one's allowed to know about it because they're so rich they can afford to lawyers to get on the newspapers.
All I'll say about that, Tony, is that I don't know enough about this case to have a strong line about it. You've obviously researched it, you've looked into it. This has just been bounced in our direction, and
I suppose the wider point is the one about fake news, isn't it? We've heard loads over the last few weeks about fake news. Now, here's a real story, which we're not allowed to hear.
Well, you say it's a real story. We don't know. Neither of us know enough about it to make a judgment.
Well, let's just say for argument's sake, I have no idea whether it's true. It probably isn't. If it was Richard Branson, and it looked like the police were investigating him for fraud, don't you think the public has a right to know about that?
In principle, I would say yes, but don't forget, we don't know enough about this case.
If, say, for example, some of his neighbours saw loads of police raiding Richard Branson's house, they took photographs of it and told the local newspapers, and the local newspapers reported it. Surely, Richard Branson cannot just simply pay lawyers to say, oh, I don't want that story to appear because it affects my reputation and it's an infringement of my privacy. You know, hang on a minute. You know, this is surely if the police are raiding you, in a public way, and it's been already in the press, it's not public, so it's not private, rather.
I think, I mean, when you look at the paedophile allegations, clearly, you know, some of the most distressing crimes of all time, and very much the case that people need to be thoroughly investigated. But we've also seen one or two cases where people were falsely accused, and when you're accused of something like that without solid evidence, then, you know, the press reporting it can do enormous damage.
Yeah, but what if it's true, if it's a fact? Like XYZ has been raided, or Harvey Proctor has been actually kicked out of the Conservative Party because he's been basically bullying young men. He was a sadist, effectively, whacking young boys. And this is why he was actually told he had to leave as an MP.
Well, if some action takes place and he's found guilty by whichever court, then basically that will come out, and that's fair enough.
Okay, very quickly, last story up. I don't know if you know, but the nuclear weapons establishment in Aldermaston is on strike.
Halt, Hal! Mr. Speaker, this country's nuclear deterrent is our ultimate defence, and it must be maintained at all costs. Yet hundreds of my constituents who work at the atomic weapons establishment are currently on strike or work to rule in a dispute over pensions. These are people who, more often than not, have devoted their entire working lives to tending our nuclear defence, and to whom promises were made during privatisation. Can I ask that the Leader of the House commits to sit down with the Prime Minister and review this situation to ensure that those promises are being kept?
Well, I'll certainly ensure that my right honourable Prime Minister is informed about this matter, and my honourable friend is absolutely right to raise these concerns on behalf of his constituents. My understanding, Mr. Speaker, is that the proposed changes to the Atomic Weapons Establishment pension scheme are a matter for the company as the employer, but I can assure my honourable friend that my right honourable friend, the Defence Secretary, has been in close contact with AWE throughout the process and has also met the trade unions, and he is now carefully considering recent developments to see what else might be done.
Did you know that Aldermaston was on strike?
Well, but it does concern me that nuclear weapons are privatised.
Well, yes, I'm concerned that they're in private hands at all. I mean, what private sector involved?
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. After the news, Gladio C, as the Syrian terrorists come to Britain, apparently.
Hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. Sports Minister Tracy Crouch says more needs to be done to put a stop to doping in Russian athletics. An independent report by Professor Richard McLaren says London 2012 was corrupted on an unprecedented scale. He found over 1,000 athletes from Russia benefited from the country's secret police hiding samples. World Anti-